It is Wednesday, January 9th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Northwest Arkansas edition of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, offering news and stories researched, written, and edited by local journalists. More information is available online at nwaonline.com.
SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, will present its Masterworks 2 concert on Saturday, January 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. The concert will feature Prokofiev's Symphony No. 5 and Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1, featuring internationally acclaimed pianist Ching Yun Hu. Tickets available at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org.
Ahead on Ozarks, a new report suggests the growing immigrant population in Arkansas is helping the state financially. Christina Thomas has a report about the new study released simultaneously yesterday in Springdale and Little Rock.
And Opera Fayetteville is back for a second act. The company will present Dead Man Walking Friday night and Sunday afternoon. And the ongoing saga of Attorney General Dustin McDaniel's relationship with an attorney in Hot Springs continues. Yesterday, he answered questions at a press conference.
First, going into the 2013 legislative session, a Medicaid shortfall is considered one of the biggest issues to solve for the General Assembly. Governor Mike Beebe, a Democrat, has spoken in favor of expanding Medicaid in the state as provided for in the federal health care law, which would bring in additional federal funding for the program. Republican leaders held a meeting this week to say they're looking at other options. The governor tells Talk Business Republican leaders should be looking at all possible solutions to the issue.
They'll synthesize all that information. They'll digest it, and then ultimately they'll provide leadership in whatever direction that they come down on. So I'm not a bit upset with the comments that I heard or the comments that I saw reported.
Beebe did say, however, he has some issues with a proposed solution of using one-time surplus funds to shore up the Medicaid shortfall.
The city of Fayetteville is considering a deal that would see the removal of an eyesore in the eastern part of town and the construction of a shiny new business. The city council will consider a sale of nearly 2 acres of the former Tyson Mexican original plant to Iowa-based convenience store chain Come & Go. Fayetteville City Attorney Kit Williams says the city has offered to sell the parcel for $900,000, and as part of the agreement, the city will share with Come & Go the cost of demolishing the old factory and other necessary land improvements.
They will pay up to 25% or up to $100,000 of the demolition costs, and it looks like there's a second commercial lot that could be sold that would have frontage on Happy Hollow, another 2-acre lot there. Well, in order to properly access it and safely access it, we wanted to have a road that would come in from the intersection into this whole 10-acre area with a lot on either side of the road. And because of that, since we don't have another developer yet or purchaser on the other side, the city owns that, so we were going to split that, and we have tentatively agreed to share that 50-50 with Come & Go.
That means the cost of constructing all of the roads surrounding the Come & Go lot would be split between the company and the city, though Come & Go would shoulder the cost of improvements to Ray Avenue to the east or of additional lanes on Highway 16 East. The city originally purchased the entire 11-acre campus in 2004 for $1.1 million. Right-of-way acquisition and construction of new fire and police stations were reasons the city bought the land almost a decade ago. But with the new Fire Station 3 completed in 2008 and renovations to the existing police station on Rock Street, the old factory has stood mostly empty. But Williams says one of the best parts of the land deal is that the eyesore that is the abandoned tortilla plant will finally be gone.
It's been vandalized. It's almost impossible to secure. The wiring has been stolen. Many pipes have been stolen. And it's got some inherent dangers in it because it has pits in there. And, of course, it's dark. And so it has been a problem for the police to keep it safe. They've had to go out there many times to try to get loiterers out and other people out that actually might injure themselves. So it has been a problem for the city, and there's been an overall desire of the city to try to make that whole lot look better by removing that structure.
The Fayetteville City Council is expected to discuss the land sale at its next meeting, January 15th.
The Arkansas Department of Health says reports of flu infections are growing in the state. The department says there have been a record 7 deaths because of the illness this year. Dr. Gary Wheeler with the Department of Health says those 7 have been older people who are more susceptible to an influenza infection. Dr. Wheeler says another group that's very susceptible is expectant mothers.
We are particularly worried about pregnant people. They have one of the highest rates of complications. And then they deliver babies who are very young, who are at risk as well. So we're really pressing hard to reach pregnant mothers. If they've not been immunized, they really need to get in immediately and get vaccinated to protect themselves.
Health officials say this is the worst flu season since 2009.
With all ballots cast, the results of yesterday's special election in Washington County are in. The election was held so residents of an area totaling fewer than 90 acres between Taneytown and Elm Springs could decide which town should annex them. With 53% voter turnout, that's 26 votes cast, 20 people voted for annexation into Elm Springs. Only 6 voted to annex into Taneytown.
Members of Congress, the Departments of Agriculture and Interior, and the Army Corps of Engineers announced yesterday that the White River and its watershed have been designated the nation's second national blueway. The designation is in recognition of the partnerships that are working to conserve the White River across its watershed from the Ozarks to the Mississippi River. The designation comes as part of President Obama's America's Great Outdoors Initiative, aimed at establishing a community-driven conservation and recreation agenda for the 21st century.
The unemployment rate dropped during the month of November in both Northwest Arkansas and Fort Smith's metropolitan statistical areas. However, the news is a mixed blessing, as the total labor force declined in both areas. According to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate in Northwest Arkansas dropped from an even 5% to 4.6%, while the labor force shrank by about 800 people. The unemployment rate in Fort Smith area similarly dropped from an even 8% to 7.6%, but the Fort Smith labor force shrank by about 1,100 people.
The Walton Family Foundation yesterday announced it has surpassed the $300 million mark in investing in charter schools across the nation. According to a press release, the foundation reached the milestone through the commitment of nearly $29 million of startup investments made in 2012, which will support 111 new schools to open in the coming years. The startup investments for 2012 were geared toward 16 investment sites or areas that serve high concentrations of low-income families and that don't offer high-performing schools to all students. Those cities include Chicago, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. According to the foundation, the startup grants have helped to serve more than 2 million students in 5,600 charter schools across the country, and investments by the foundation have supported the creation of more than 1,400 charter schools since 1997.
The Diamond Hogs won't be the only Razorback team to start its season at the top of the rankings. Like the UA baseball team, the University of Arkansas track and field team has topped a preseason poll. The U.S. Track and Field and Cross Country Coaches Association poll was released yesterday, and the Razorback track and field team is at the top. Friday, the Razorbacks open competition at the Randall Tyson Track Center with a dual meet against Texas. The Longhorns are ranked third in that same preseason poll.
The National Weather Service says tonight's weather forecast calls for overcast conditions with a 100% chance of rain with thunderstorms after midnight and a low in the mid to upper 40s. Tomorrow, expect those overcast conditions to continue with a high of 59 degrees, an 80% chance of rain in northwest Arkansas, and a 70% chance of rain in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, expect partly cloudy skies with a low in the low to mid 40s. This is Ozarks at Large. Yesterday, the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation released a new 3-volume report regarding the state's immigration population. The report concentrates on the years between 2000 and 2010 and says Arkansas had the 4th highest rate of immigration population in the United States during that decade.
But it should be noted the state's immigrant population remains below the national average. The report also says the growth in the immigrant population has been beneficial to the state's economy. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas has more about the new study that was released yesterday.
Yesterday, at press conferences in both Little Rock and Springdale, the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation released a new report, A Profile of Immigrants in Arkansas 2013. It's a follow-up to a similar study conducted in 2007. Corey Anderson, vice president of the foundation, explains why the organization stands behind such research.
The work that we do is really based on the work that the late Governor Winthrop Rockefeller did during his lifetime. He was really all about closing gaps and making sure that everybody in the state had an opportunity to succeed take care of their family, and build their community. We really feel like this report relates directly to that.
That being said, he says the institution wants to ensure that folks have the information they need to make decisions concerning immigrants. Folks like the state legislature that's about to begin session.
Well, sure. Again, it's about making sure that the folks have data. I mean, the discussion about, again, supporting immigrant families and their children is a national discussion that's taking on legs in different ways in every state in the country. As a foundation, we feel like it's our responsibility to make sure that folks have what they need to really make good decisions. Mm-hmm.
The overall conclusion of the report is that immigrants have a positive impact on Arkansas, economically, fiscally, and socially. The report is broken down into three volumes: demographics, economics, and a section on the Marshallese community. Outside of the Marshall Islands, Arkansas is home to the second highest population of Marshallese, behind Hawaii. About 4,300 Marshallese currently live in Arkansas, primarily in Springdale. Due to special laws between the two countries, the Marshallese are considered visitors, not immigrants, and therefore do not factor into the 5% of Arkansas population that is made up by immigrants. The report says that while Arkansas's immigrant population is small, the state ranks fourth in the nation for its immigrant growth rate of 82% between 2000 and 2010. Randy Capps of the Migration Policy Institute is the lead author of Volume 1 of the report, Changing Workforce and Demographics. He was one of many speakers on hand to summarize the report. He says that Arkansas is well below the 13% immigrant population for the nation.
And then we have seen a slowdown nationally in immigration, particularly immigration from Mexico, which has not really seen any increase over the last 5 years. We've seen less of a slowdown here in Arkansas. The economy here has been stronger than it has been nationally, and that has made the climate of the state a bit more receptive.
Larger states have a higher percentage. Immigrants are also keeping the population young and vibrant.
The non-Hispanic white population in the state is aging, with the most rapid growth over age 45. This is what we demographers refer to as the aging of the baby boomers. On the other hand, during the last decade, the fastest growth rate for children was in the Latino child population. So we have an increase of about 38,000 Latino children at the same time that we had a decline of about 23,000 white children.
This is having a positive impact on the workforce. And 88% of Latino men, Latinos making up two-thirds of the immigrant population, 88% are employed. That's a higher percentage than any other group of men. Corey Anderson, vice president of Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, says that they go where the jobs are.
The researchers really talk about it in terms of access to jobs. The science and the data will tell you that, you know, immigrants are settling where there are jobs available for them because they're filling these job gaps that are there. So I think that's most of it.
The report shows that 44% of the immigrant population resides in northwest Arkansas, 17% in the Little Rock metro area, and the rest scattered throughout the state.
And even if you looked at places, there are some places in west central Arkansas, some smaller towns like DeQueen, where there are significant immigrant populations. And again, those are, if you talk to immigrants there and the businesses there, they'll tell you that that's all driven by the availability of jobs.
Those jobs are typically in the construction, manufacturing, or healthcare industry, resulting in huge wage savings in those areas. Contrary to what many may believe, immigrants are not competition for the native population, but rather complementary. Steve Appold is one of those responsible for the 50-page second volume of the report, which looks at immigrants' impact both economically and fiscally. He says it's written from the native-born perspective. Is immigration beneficial to me?
It is, at least in the short term. By some measures, the net immigrant benefit is large. By others, it's more modest. But in every case, the net benefit in Arkansas as of 2010 is positive.
They say 2010 because that's the last year that census data was recorded. Appold confirms that one of those areas is Arkansas's workforce.
The supply of highly educated Arkansans has not kept pace with employment demand in business services and healthcare, leading to an influx of generally well-educated immigrants, some from elsewhere in the U.S., others directly from abroad. The number of Arkansas natives employed in low-skill occupations in some areas of manufacturing, particularly animal slaughtering, but also construction and selected services, has declined more quickly than labor demand in these industries.
Again, 88% of the male immigrant Latino population in Arkansas is employed, resulting in income. And the estimated total after-tax income is $4.3 billion. 16% of that is sent to families abroad, saved or used for interest payments. See, because 50% of those own homes. After that, the total economic impact of the remaining immigrant consumer spending on the Arkansas economy is $3.9 billion. They're adding $3.9 billion to Arkansas's GDP.
The four counties with the largest immigrant buying power, Pulaski, Benton, Washington, and Sebastian, accounted for over half the consumer spending impact, economic impact of the immigrant population in 2010. All right. Let me work through this. Arkansas residents, whether native or foreign-born, impose costs and offer benefits to the state's economy. In investigating the fiscal impacts of Arkansas immigrants, we looked at two types of contributions.
Those areas are consumption tax and income and property taxes, resulting in over $520 million in income in 2010. Some may argue that immigrants cost the state money, but for every dollar the state spends on an immigrant, whether on Medicaid or public schools, that immigrant brings in $7. Here's Corey Anderson.
All of us, you know, no matter what your status is or your point of origin, all of us cost something just to be here. You know, whether it's the road we drive on or a subsidy for our health care or something, all of us have a cost. And all of us have a benefit that sort of goes up and down. So, again, in that sense, they're just like everybody else here. They're making a major contribution. They're paying taxes, whether it's employment taxes or sales taxes or the fees that it takes to register your car. They're buying groceries, and they're buying homes and clothes. And so there's a residual impact of the taxes off of those things. So again, they're making a major contribution. And I think we feel like it, you know, it sort of behooves us as a state to have whatever conversation we're going to have it with good data as the beginning.
It's been 6 years since the Foundation's previous report in 2007. If a third report is conducted in another 6 years, say in 2019, what might that data look like?
That our native-born population is an aging population, and our birth rates of native-born folks are continuing to go down, and the birth rates of immigrants and other folks are continuing to go up, at least at this point. So if you extrapolate that out, what we'll probably see is more of the same. And again, for us, this is really about the future of the state and about whether or not we're doing what we need to be doing right now to make sure that as all kids grow up and get older, they've got the skills and opportunities that they need. And as we think about the children of immigrants, again, most of these are U.S.-born kids. They're citizens. But as we think about them, you know, whether or not we're being deliberate in our economic systems and our school systems and the way that we think about our communities, whether or not we're being deliberate in building in those supports that are necessary.
You can view the report in its entirety at wrfoundation.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, it's another name brand interview you won't want to miss. It was R.J. Mischow and his good friend from Minnesota, Jeremy Johnson. I've played all the songs on previous shows, but this is the first time I've put the interview together. That's Friday night at 9 o'clock, the Generic Blues Show on KUAF. We'll see you then.
Attorney General Dustin McDaniel is trying to clear up questions surrounding his self-described inappropriate relationship with Andrea Davis, an attorney in Hot Springs. Yesterday, he conducted a press conference in Little Rock, and Maggie Carroll from our content partner KUAR has this report.
McDaniel clarified that while he is ashamed of his actions, the affair was a personal mistake and did not involve the use of state resources, finances, or employees.
I want to use this morning to be clear about what I have done wrong, and equally clear about what I have not done wrong. I continue to hear that rumors are swirling about whether some other shoe will drop. There is no other shoe to drop. There are no other women. There is no litigation that was ever compromised. No rules of professional conduct were ever violated.
The gubernatorial hopeful says that in regards to Ms. Davis's clients, the office's work was never compromised and the state won all five cases. He is thankful for the support he has received during this difficult time and confirmed that he still intends to seek the office of governor in 2014. He stated that he never considered stepping aside from his current office and is too committed to the people of Arkansas to withdraw from the race. When asked how he would regain public trust, McDaniel said he will have to show people he is trustworthy, not simply tell them.
You know, I was a police officer, and I think you knew Floyd Johnson, who was the former sheriff and my chief of police. And when I was fresh out of college, he said, when you get in trouble, you need to come in and tell me before I find out some other way. And so I was prone to walk into his office and tell him when I'd made a mistake. When I released my statement to the media just before Christmas, to me that was like walking into the office with my 3 million bosses and telling them that I'd made a mistake. And it'll be up to them to decide whether to accept my explanation and my apology and how we move forward.
The attorney general says he is running for governor because he is proud of his record and believes in Arkansas's ability to make visionary investments for the future. In Little Rock, I'm Maggie Carroll.
The unfolding storyline surrounding the attorney general and gubernatorial candidate have been creating conversations about the viability of Dustin McDaniel in his effort to succeed Governor Mike Beebe. The attorney general remains the only announced candidate for the Democratic nomination, but many observers doubt that he'll be the only one once the real campaign season for 2014 begins. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business recently brought up the subject with two of Arkansas's most read political bloggers, Jason Tolbert of the right-leaning Tolbert Report and Michael Cook of the more left Cook's Outlook. It should be noted that their conversation took place before yesterday's press conference.
First off, McDaniel issues a statement confirming that this relationship took place. Kind of what was the immediate reaction that you guys got from some of the politicos and observers that you talked to?
Well, the immediate reaction, it sort of confirmed a rumor that people have been hearing for some time. People hadn't put a lot of credence in the rumor because they weren't sure if it was true or not. But once he admitted that, then people started looking a lot more closely at who is this lady, what was going on there. And really, McDaniel's statement left a lot of unanswered questions, so people really started wondering, what's going on here?
Some of those questions were, what is a limited interaction?
Right.
What was the extent of the inappropriate part of the relationship? What were
right.
you hearing initially?
Initially, the first emotion I heard from Democrats was just disappointment. Disappointment in what he had done and the whole affair in more ways than one. And then it's kind of slowly turning to a little bit of anger as the story has progressed, anger and disappointment because he had everything lined up just right in terms of raising money, seemingly on the march to the nomination, maybe even the governor's mansion, and then now to completely blow himself up made a lot of his supporters and potential supporters just disappointed and angry and wanting more questions answered.
Is there any kind of inclination in what we've seen in some of McDaniel's early governor's campaign strategy? Getting out there and raising money mm-hmm. early, floating the trial balloon, I guess earlier, about 2 weeks ago, that he was the front runner for the nomination, but he would maybe struggle against Asa Hutchinson. Do we see now how some of that was used strategically?
Yeah. Inadvertently, though, I think he has set himself up for failure in this regard. First, of course, the affair is a failure, but he released a poll where he showed against two potential Democratic primary opponents, John Burkhalter and Bill Halter. His own internal poll showed him with 54% of the vote against these two other potential candidates. One, I never believed that was that high. The problem for McDaniel now is eventually somebody's going to do a poll of the primary and release it, and he'll be at 35, 38, and the story will be McDaniel dropping like a rock, you know, losing 15, 18, 20 points. So now he has other political problems to face as the race for the Democratic primary unfolds, whoever the other candidates are.
All right, Jason.
No, I think he's right. And I think you see almost some premeditation in some of those things that he did. The raising the money early, the putting out that poll right before this news broke. He knew this news was eventually going to come out.
No doubt.
And people don't really have an appetite for when people try to handle this type of thing from a political strategic point of view. He did make the admission, he did admit it, but he admitted it sort of in his own way after he already had over $1 million in the bank. I know some of his donors have to be upset I'm sure they didn't know this news when they wrote those checks to him.
Well, I talked to somebody who had literally has a check written and was going to send it in, and then they decided, literally, I'm going to hold off and find out how this shakes out. Of course, it's just one person, doesn't mean it's the whole state, but it is indicative of he has a lot of problems and a lot of repair work to do. But this story, unfortunately, is going to continue, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Well, and let's talk about just kind of how the scandal played out the rest of the week.
Right.
Some of it because of the way McDaniel's office responded to the media requests for more information.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what I think became a big issue in the day two part of this story was that this relationship between mm-hmm. the lawyer and his office, even though I don't think they had any direct connection with each other, there is the appearance of impropriety there and a lack of knowledge.
Right.
Jason?
Sure, there's a lot of layers here that you have to work through. And that's the bad thing about a story like this for McDaniel, is every layer creates a new story and a new press cycle. So it's not just one kind of shocking story. It continues to drip out as we peel this thing back. And you're right, there's the layer of, was there any ethical problems between an attorney having a relationship with the opposing counsel? Did that cause any problems? And even if there weren't any problems, the question at least gets asked and gets discussed. You know, and then there's the other layer as to some of the circumstances surrounding Andy Davis. And so when you start looking at all these different things, there may be another layer that we find out about next week that we don't know about now. And so the story just feeds itself and just continues to come out one story at a time.
Mm-hmm. Jason's on something. You know, this could have been a very cut and dry case where the elected official says, I made a mistake, I had a personal indiscretion, and then, you know, I apologize, and then we move on. But all these other things are now coming into play. There's the person he had the affair with. I mean, I wrote today, you know, when they have a phrase, you know, McDaniel's mistress was led away in handcuffs after a murdered man was found in her driveway, you've got some political problems on your hands.
Right.
So these are things that McDaniel, and it's getting to the point where it's almost too late to fix the damage. As crazy as it sounds, it's still 2012, we're not even in 2013, but the way he has mishandled the telling of the story and getting all the facts out, this is getting worse and worse by the day.
So we've got other political candidates who could capitalize on this, but there's not a lot of strong candidates out there. Mike Ross, who would have been one of the stronger candidates mm-hmm. to challenge Dustin McDaniel, had already ruled out a governor's run. He says, again, this late in the week, I'm still not going to be a candidate for governor. I've been approached, but I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Asa Hutchinson is probably the front runner on the Republican side at this point in time. I guess, Jason, do you still consider Dustin McDaniel the front runner for the Democratic nomination?
I would still say he's the front runner, but he's a much weaker front runner than he's ever been. He should be very thankful that Mike Ross has already made the decision he's going to go into the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
If that decision hadn't been made, I think he would be in major trouble. There are still some other strong candidates that are looking at opposing him that will give him definitely a run for his money. If he decides to stay in it, that could be the best case scenario for Republicans, because if he stays in it with the money that he's raised, with the name recognition he already has, he could very well survive the primary and enter the general election perhaps the weakest candidate Democrats could field to run against the Republican. So that may be a gift the Democrats could give to the mm-hmm. Republican Party if they're looking to give them a Christmas present, is to make Dustin McDaniel the nominee.
Yeah, a couple things. Yes, he's still a front runner, but a very weak front runner at this moment. Of course, he's the only officially announced candidate for governor, so of course it's easy to be the front runner when there's nobody else out there. There's other two potential candidates that have floated their name out there. Little Rock businessman John Burkhalter, who people are saying that he would probably put a lot of his own money in, which would make him a player. And then former Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter, who has ran for the U.S. Senate unsuccessfully in 2010, but still has name recognitions. Both of those are credible candidates. But there's not a lot of excitement right now around their candidacies. Not that could change. And there's certainly a possibility somebody else may enter, somebody who's a credible candidate, not well-known maybe statewide, but who could build a base. But the problem for Democrats right now is, as we sit here today, with McDaniel as the nominee, we have problems because he's mishandled this whole situation. So unless he fixes the problem in the next week or so, then Democrats may need to say, is this the person we need at leading our ticket in 2014? I mean, it's that tight of a window where he's got to fix this quickly.
And the ramifications are much bigger than just the governor's mansion. I mean, you're looking at Democrats trying to retake the House
mm-hmm.
coming up. It's just a 51-48
right.
split there in the House. This could feed down to those other races that normally campaign mm-hmm. with with the governor candidate. They were able to campaign with Mike Beebe very effectively in the last election cycle. If McDaniel's at the top of the ticket, this could really damage them as well.
Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business talked with bloggers Jason Tolbert and Michael Cook about Attorney General Dustin McDaniel and the 2014 race for Arkansas governor late last week. You can hear more from the conversation at talkbusiness.net.
Support for talkbusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Opera Fayetteville has collected some of the best young voices in America, and they'll present Dead Man Walking twice this weekend. We'll have a preview in about 2 minutes. And on tomorrow's show, more live music from the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Adams Collins and his musician friends played a tune from his new CD, Coffee Pot, and we'll hear that tomorrow. The CD is officially released Thursday night at Scarpino's in Fayetteville. And speaking of new CDs, the debut disc from Stone Cricket featuring Rogers native Ryan Fort is now available at cdbaby.com and iTunes. Ryan was back in Arkansas last month to play some shows, and at that time he came to our studio. Now the band's CD is available for anybody who wants to hear it.
It is Wednesday, January 9th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. How are you doing, Becca?
I'm all right, Kyle. How are
good.
You?
Very good.
Interesting topic for an opera.
Yes, it's the second season of Opera Fayetteville.
And the opera is called Dead Man Walking.
And it is of that same sister...
Helen Prejean.
Prejean, who's been to the university a couple times, and there was also a film and a novel about this.
She was here with the Dalai Lama,
right?
If you remember that. And she wrote a book about her efforts to counsel a convicted murderer. It is now an opera. With libretto by Terrence McNally.
Yes, and this, to me, that's a subject that seems ripe for an opera of contemporary.
I would think so. And her goal, Tamara Ryan's goal with Opera Fayetteville, is to do contemporary opera. Should be interesting. Two performances only, 7:30 Friday and 3 o'clock Sunday at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the university campus in Fayetteville. Tickets are $18.
Last year they did Little Women, a newer, more contemporary version of Little Women.
And, of course, remember, Catch Me If You Can continues at the Walton Arts Center.
Okay. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm Ira Glass, and we got a tip at our show This American Life this week that a pork processor was taking the very bottom of a pig's intestines, the rectum, and slicing it into rings and selling that product as imitation calamari. Can it be true? Well, we investigated, including
my gut reaction is that
a taste
this
test.
Was, this was calamari.
Porky
was
doppelgangers
totally...
this week.
This American Life, Saturday morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This weekend, Opera Fayetteville returns to the Stella Boyle Smith stage on the University of Arkansas campus with two performances of Dead Man Walking. The production is the second for the company, following last year's staging of Little Women. The company itself is the production of Tamara Ryan, the founder and general director of Opera Fayetteville.
I've learned mostly what a wonderful joy it is to bring a bunch of people together and make this beautiful opera. I've gotten to know what it's like to coordinate lighting people and sound people and sort of all the different steps that you need. Last year it was kind of one emergency after another, and this year we had a little more of a plan.
This second production, like the company's first last January, is ambitious in almost every way. Cast and crew are assembled from afar and trickle into Fayetteville in the days between Christmas and New Year's. The orchestra, under the direction of Robert Mueller, is more than 30 musicians strong, and the opera chosen for this weekend, Dead Man Walking, is a dark, contemporary work based on a true story of violence, forgiveness, and acrimony. It is an account of the relationship between Sister Helen Prejean and convicted murderer Joseph de Rocher, first recounted in the nun's book and later in an Oscar-winning film. Tamara Ryan says the work, with music by Jake Heggie and libretto by Terrence McNally, is exactly the opposite of what she originally wanted for the second Opera Fayetteville production.
I spent the entire spring sitting down and I made this elaborate chart and I listened to all of these modern operas with the libretto, and I had kind of, you know, we need maybe a smaller orchestra and we need not to have too much of a chorus requirement and there can't be an elaborate set, and I was sort of checking off boxes and tallying. I had a scoring system for what would be most appropriate. And then I listened to Dead Man Walking over the course of 3 days, just completely inappropriate for all of those reasons. And I was done, and I was sitting in my living room crying, and I just felt sort of a tug on my soul, and I thought, well, okay, this has to be it.
That artistic merit triumphed in her selection over pragmatism isn't a shock. Tamara's goals for Opera Fayetteville include staging recent English-language operas with rising talent gathered from across the country. But for the show's director, Kyle Lang, the choice represented an interesting state of affairs. The intense opera, with many scenes set inside a prison and an act of brutal violence that opens the show, had to be created inside the intimate setting of Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. He uses almost the entire space as stage, allowing the prison warden to lead Sister Helen down off the stage and around the venue and back to simulate a tour of the prison.
Well, that had to do with the space itself. the set is super minimal. And there are 17, almost 18 scenes, because the end of the Act One finale is almost... I treated it somewhat as a different scene than the scene prior. There's so many scenes that you have to keep it moving. And I was forced to find a way to, without a set, change location and also give the opportunity for those small scene changes to happen as far as the set goes.
Dead Man Walking was commissioned by the San Francisco Opera and first staged in 2000. The work is filled with characters forced to grapple with issues of death, capital punishment, brutality, revenge, and compassion. Lindsay Anderson, who lives in New York City, is Sister Helen in this weekend's production.
It's been a journey, to quote the aria that I sing, learning about Sister Helen, and it's made me feel, you know, like a better person almost, because it's forced me to think about this question. That's something we wouldn't have to deal with on a daily basis, whether or not I could be able to support this person who committed such a horrible act, and to put aside my feelings, my personal feelings about it, to sacrifice that for the greater good and for God. And I'm not sure if I could do it still as myself, but it really makes me admire Sister Helen for being able to do that.
Kyle Lang, the director, says Lindsay Anderson and Daniel Schofield, who has the role of Joseph de Rocher, the condemned murderer sentenced to die in Louisiana's infamous Angola Penitentiary, were among the first cast members to arrive in Fayetteville and have both been fully engaged in fleshing out their roles.
But no, the subject matter is so dense, it's so heavy, and these characters are very... they seem very simple at first, but come to find out they're very layered emotionally. And I think, you know, as for them, it changes a lot as the show develops. And it's just layer on layer. And that is reflected in the libretto. It's reflected in the music as well. And it's very dense. It's very intense.
Daniel Schofield from Binghamton, New York, has the difficult task of showing us a man convicted of a gruesome, almost unimaginable crime, but asking for spiritual guidance from Sister Helen.
We see this sort of repentant side of Joseph, and he's been living this lie in prison that he's tricked himself into believing that he hasn't done it, and he's never really lived up to it. And so we see this repentant, sympathetic side to the character the entire time. However, for the audience, it's got to be strange for them because they saw him commit this despicable act in the first few minutes, and then for the rest of the story, they're made to feel sorry for him. So, and that's kind of the challenge of the role, is to be able to play both sides of the character.
Another challenge? Crossing the stage and singing while in handcuffs and leg irons. His scenes take place inside the maximum security prison.
It's a challenge to move. Honestly, I mean, we blocked for the last week, and I didn't have any ankle cuffs or handcuffs, and now I find my mobility's a little bit more limited. I can do less jumping jacks on stage. It's harder.
Kyle Lang, the opera's director, has been assistant director for productions at Central City Opera and Opera Baltimore, and has danced at the Metropolitan Opera, Lyric Opera of Chicago, and Santa Fe Opera. This, though, is his first director's job. Even though he now lives in Washington, D.C., he has a geographical connection to Dead Man Walking.
I grew up in Louisiana, and actually grew up going to Angola to the prison rodeo every October as a child.
Music is riveting, measures change often, and choruses from different parts of the room create chilling tapestries. And the finale, referred to in the title of the opera, is a condemned man's fate. Again, Kyle Lang.
So because of the space, having the orchestra take up the entire stage left, I was forced to really pull it out into the audience, which initially, I'm not going to talk about the finale because it's pretty chilling, but I had already had a previous idea for the finale, which when I got to the space, instantly I was like, oh, this is going to work. So
this weekend's production is the second for Opera Fayetteville, and Tamara Ryan, the founder of the company, says she really isn't allowing herself to think about the third production, presumably in January 2014, but she's pretty sure she'll be thinking about it soon.
Even though I live in Boston, and because I have a singing career and that needs to happen sort of in a metropolitan area, that's where I live, but I really love Fayetteville, and I was so attached to the idea of bringing this dream here last year, and having done it once, I got way more hooked even than I thought it would be. I think last year, to some degree, it was an experiment, and I thought, you know, you'll have this amazing experience, you'll put this together, and if it turns out to be a horrible mistake, what a glorious mistake to make, and you'll just move on. Yeah, and even in terms of my own career as a singer, I keep thinking, you know, maybe you'll do a few shows and then you'll pass the reins on to somebody, you'll kind of get it started. But the more I work on it, the more I just feel sort of so in love with this baby.
Fayetteville Opera's production of Dead Man Walking will be on stage at Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the University of Arkansas campus Friday night at 7:30 and again Sunday afternoon at 3. Tickets are $18, and more information can be found at operafayetteville.org. It should be noted that the production includes mature themes and language.
This is Ozarks at Large. The United States Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments today to determine whether police officers can take blood tests from drunk driving suspects without a warrant. The case originated in rural Missouri, and Jacob McClelland of our content partner KCRU in Cape Girardeau has this report.
The case Missouri versus McNeely comes down to this. Should police go through the time-consuming process of getting a warrant to conduct a blood test on a presumed drunk driver? Jack Kester says no. He's an assistant prosecuting attorney in Cape Girardeau County, and he's representing the state in front of the Supreme Court. Kester says police shouldn't have to stand around and wait while evidence is being destroyed.
When a police officer has probable cause to believe someone has committed a drunk driving related crime, it is objectively reasonable to conclude that the evidence, the most probative evidence of the crime, will continue to dissipate during the inevitable delay necessary to obtain a search warrant.
It typically takes an officer about an hour and a half or 2 hours to obtain a warrant. During that time, the suspect is sitting around, metabolizing that alcohol, essentially destroying evidence. The court has ruled that warrantless searches are sometimes okay outside of drunk driving cases. Police, for instance, can enter a suspect's home if they believe they hear evidence being destroyed, like drugs flushing down the toilet. Eric Zond is the Platte County Prosecuting Attorney and President of the Missouri Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, who support the state. Zond says this is similar to a drunk driving arrest.
The blood is being metabolized by the body, really, whether the defendant or the suspect wants that blood to be metabolized or not. And if we don't get to it soon enough, it'll be gone.
When the Missouri Highway Patrol arrested Tyler McNeely, he refused the breathalyzer and a blood test. The arresting officer took him to a hospital, where staff drew a blood sample without a warrant. By all accounts, this was a run-of-the-mill DWI arrest. Upon hearing the same case, the Missouri Supreme Court ruled special facts, like an injury, need to be present before an officer can bypass the warrant requirement. The ACLU's Steve Shapiro, who represents McNeely, says the state's interest in drawing blood has to be balanced against privacy interests when the state pokes a needle in somebody's arm against their will.
It's very different than going to the doctor where you are consenting to a medical procedure and the doctor is performing it in your best interest. Here, the state is doing what it's doing over your objection just so it can have an easier time prosecuting you for a crime.
A lot of this goes back to a 1966 Supreme Court decision, Schmerber versus California. The drunk driver, Schmerber, was injured during an accident, and it was hours later before police could get a blood test. Under these circumstances, the High Court ruled the warrantless blood draw was constitutional due to exigent circumstances. But that decision led to different interpretations. Some states think it means warrantless blood tests are allowable in all DWI arrests, whereas other states believe police must get a warrant unless it's an emergency. Lynn Blaze is a law professor at the University of Texas, and she co-authored a brief in favor of McNeely. She says a case-by-case analysis is practical.
I don't mean to suggest that a totality of the circumstances evaluation is always easy, but it is always easy for the police to assume they need a warrant, and only in circumstances where there's a special concern should they even think it will be reasonable for me to proceed without one. That's not sort of a routine DUI.
Jack Kester says if the court rules in the state's favor, fewer drunk drivers will refuse the breathalyzer. But the ACLU's Steve Shapiro believes the implications go beyond privacy concerns and is a matter of personal dignity. In Cape Girardeau, Missouri, I'm Jacob McClelland.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
About 1 zillion CDs are released every year.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep up.
I can't even begin to be close to it. I get some because, you know, you listen to a lot, you buy a lot, you'll bring them in and I'll kind of look them over and things like that. I have friends that are really into music, so that helps narrow it down for me.
Down the hall, we have Katie Hendrickson.
We do.
Who's into music.
Yes.
And on this edition of Ozarks at Large, she begins a service, a public service of these lesser-known CDs that she thinks are worth a listen.
The way we come to music is important. We happen on a piece that strikes our core in odd moments, maybe with the headphones on, from a playlist sent by a friend while walking home from work in steel gray January. As a music journalist, it's often through publicists who send out a dizzying volume of new releases each day and hope she'll cover their newest client. In the case of Speck Mountain, it was via a note from a musician I highly regarded, one Sharon Van Etten, whose sophomore release on Jag Jaguar tore my heart out with an immediacy on the first single, Serpents. I'd interviewed her back in 2010, and she'd written me to thank me for the piece as well as ask if I'd blog about a show she was putting together for Friends, the bands She Keeps Bees and Speck Mountain. Speck Mountain, whose core duo is Carl Breedrich, guitar, and Marie-Claire Balabanian, vocals and bass, formed in Brooklyn in 2005. And by the time they self-released their debut in 2006, they'd made their way to Chicago, a slightly more affordable alternative to the city that never sleeps. There was a second release in 2009 on Chicago's indie label Carrot Top, but they didn't hit my radar until the note from Sharon Van Etten about the show. In moments when you really fall in love with an album, all those
adjectives just don't quite live up. You can try to describe it. Speck Mountain, a melodic textured landscape of a subdued slow burn. This is the embers of a long glowing fire, so intense yet showing little flame. In this album, they added drummer Chris Dye and Linda Malonis, who plays organ. She's also described in a press release as having been a former Pentecostal church pianist turned drone rock organist. I haven't been able to stop listening to these nine devastating songs since they hit my desk. Shoegaze, reverb mixed with sultry twang, lots of pedal delays and layers of echoey organ synths. Stunning from the first seconds and opener Caught Up to closer Watch the Storm, which haunts me each moment in its 6 minutes and 31 seconds. It's one of those songs I loop on repeat for an hour, just dwelling in its world until nothing exists. Speck Mountain's new release, Bad Water, comes out January 22nd on Carrot Top Records. It's an album I will be returning to again and again and again. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Elm Springs.
And welcome back.
Thank you.
Been on vacation.
I have.
Saw the Grand Canyon.
I saw the Grand Canyon.
It's big.
It's so grand. It was quite grand.
Well.
Quite big.
And cold this time of year, I take it.
So cold. I did not think that through, that it's the winter. There was all sorts of snow on the ground and ice. I mean, they clean up the roads pretty well, but some of the trails were pretty icy and some spills were had by people.
I've been there twice.
Uh-huh.
I still don't comprehend, and I don't think there's any way because you can never see all of it. I can't comprehend how big, how deep
right.
it is. Did you get any sort of sense of that?
I had a good sense in that we drove to the western part first and then drove to the entrance to the south rim. And we were just sort of talking about how many hours it took from one to the other and how that's only like halfway.
Right.
I mean, it's like 4 hours from the western part to kind of the middle, like main part where a lot of people go. Because the north rim is closed because of all the snow and stuff during the winter.
Right.
And all that good stuff. So, and you're like, that's only like halfway.
Right. And it's I found it, both times I've been there, a humbling experience. Like,
yeah.
Wow. You know, that's just one little crevice.
Sure.
Not little, but on this planet, in this universe.
Sure. No, it was very pretty, and I'm really glad I got to see it. I've wanted to see it for a really long time, so.
Well, I'm glad you're back.
Yes.
And thanks to Christina Thomas and Jacqueline Froelich and Timothy Dennis for helping us out over the past few weeks.
Yes.
Very appreciated. We're all kind of back together now.
Mm-hmm.
Hope everyone had a great holiday season. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
You and I will be back together Friday.
We will.
Christina comes back in tomorrow. And all is well, right?
All is well.
Thanks, Antoinette.
Thanks.